is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Let's turn now to Mort Marcus, a well-known Indiana economist, writer, and a public speaker. You see his columns in the local media and the Eye in the Pie column that's around. And let's quiz him about some of the topics that he's had on this recent round of Eye on the Pie columns. Morton, you're on the road, I understand, and hope you're doing well and you're doing it safely at least.
Well, I'm safe so far.
Okay, we'll leave it at that then. Okay, that's good too. Let's start in here with your latest column I've got handy here, talking about the reasons for and the irrationality of regions. And we must be in this case talking primarily, I guess, about geography. A little geography lesson, no doubt.
Well, the point is there are so many different ways of saying where does what is Northwest Indiana, for example.
Yeah.
Does LaPorte County, is that really part of Northwest Indiana, or is it part of North Central Indiana over with South Bend? And there are people in LaPorte County who will swear that the only way to think about this is in terms of aligning LaPorte County with Porter and Lake. There are others who will say that's nonsense, that we're really very much similar to the issues in South Bend.
Right.
I don't have an answer to that. All I know is that we have so many different regional variations. I once counted it up, and I could find at that time over 20 different regional alignments in the state of Indiana. It's what I call laissez-faire regionalism, meaning any two consenting counties could get together as long as they touched each other.
Right.
It was very sexual, and I think that there may be other ways of looking at things that make much more sense than geography. For example, there are counties in Indiana that are primarily urban counties, that is, people living in cities and towns. Lake County is one of them, very clearly. Marion County, Indianapolis, is clearly one of them. Vandenberg County, Evansville, and you can just go through the state and say there are urban counties. Maybe those urban counties should be considered a region. Maybe they should have the kind of organizations for economic development and for other purposes that is not dependent on geography, but is dependent really on the kinds of assets that they have that Stark County and Jasper and Newton don't necessarily have. I can understand Jasper and Newton being associated with Lake and Porter because of certain ties of commuting patterns and some physical situations such as the Kankakee River is of consequence to all four counties. But this idea that the metropolitan area for Lake and Porter counties includes Jasper and Newton really doesn't make a lot of sense. But that's a decision that has been made by the Office of Management and Budget in Washington, and it's one that is then forced upon many agencies getting federal funds.
Yeah,
we can go on and on in this kind of...
Yeah, in that particular, we're talking about the Metropolitan Statistical Area, I guess, the MSA,
that's how
Jasper and Newton end up getting lumped together with the other three counties there because of that. Yeah.
They don't get lumped together with LaPorte County because LaPorte County is a metropolitan area all its own.
Uh-huh.
And then that raises questions, why isn't it blended in with either St. Joseph County or with Lake and Porter. But the federal government doesn't do it that way. Let me tell you just a little story here.
Okay.
I was at one point trying to work on issues concerning the Great Lakes. So I wanted to know, what are the Great Lakes counties? Well, the simplest way of looking at it is, what counties touch the Great Lakes? Well, then the only two counties in Indiana that touch the Great Lakes, three counties, are Lake Porter and LaPorte. But it's also true that the river that flows through St. Joe County, South Bend, the St. Joseph River, goes into Lake Michigan. So, and Elkhart also, the same river, goes into Lake Michigan. From a watershed point of view, what you've got is five counties that flow, have their water flowing into Lake Michigan. Fort Wayne is a Great Lakes county because its river, the Maumee, flows into Ohio through Toledo and into Lake Erie. So I called the Indiana Department of Natural Resources, and they said, oh, no, we don't do that. We only do those that actually touch the lake. And I don't understand why that is the case. It seems to me that if you're going to have a geographical basis for this, and you're interested in the Great Lakes, and you're interested in the water in the Great Lakes, or pollution in the Great Lakes, you've got to look at all the counties that contribute water to those Great Lakes. But the Department of Natural Resources made an arbitrary decision that, oh, we'll go with this. And again, so many of these regional matters are either political or arbitrary bureaucratic decisions.
One of the other columns that you had out recently, and we've kind of mentioned it ahead of time in talking about the opportunity to speak with you today, is the one column where you stray from Indiana economic news. You very rarely talk about national issues, but a recent column you had to make an exception, and that was involving, I guess, what President Trump had to say about the national employment numbers on Friday, June 1st, and you had some thoughts about that and why the president seems to have gotten involved in that.
Well, that was very disturbing because we've had a long tradition in this country of keeping data, keeping information to a very limited group of people. And the president is one of them, of course, but they're not supposed to talk about it. The data are embargoed. The press may have hold of them in advance, as they do in many cases, so they can write their stories and put those stories out, broadcast them at the time that they are released. That makes sense. I have never seen any violation of those rules, which come from the Office of Management and Budget. I've never seen any violation of those rules by anybody in the press. I've never heard a report at 8 o'clock in the morning that says, oh, later today, the Labor Department is going to announce that our unemployment figures are down or up or whatever.
Yeah, you may just hear them.
They just don't do that.
You may hear about saying later this morning you're going to hear the numbers come out and knowing this is going to happen.
But the president said, I'm looking forward to it. Well, if the president is looking forward to it, it means it's in his favor. Why would he say that otherwise? He wouldn't say, I'm looking forward to these numbers because they're going to show how bad things are. No, he's going to show how good things are. And that just bothers me because that's the first step in what could be a very dangerous situation where ultimately the president or somebody in the Department of Labor says, we have to have good numbers. And there's always suspicion that the government is doing this. But there's no evidence that the government does it. The statisticians in the government are, I can't say they're pure, but they're as good as you're going to find in terms of political influence. They're just not likely to produce numbers that please whoever happens to be the president or the secretary of labor or whatever position it is. And as a person who has spent a lifetime using these numbers, I don't want somebody fiddling with them. I want to know what reality is, and I don't want them adjusted for the whims of the moment. And I think that citizens ought to be very concerned about that. So I wrote that column just because I was very upset is what it comes down to. I had trouble sleeping that night that happened because I was just so angry. There are a lot of things that Mr. Trump does that I just laugh at. Mm-hmm. And I say, he's a funny character. He's different from others. This was crossing the line.
Well, I noticed in particular the first sentence of the last paragraph of that particular column states, meddling with these data for political reasons must not happen. And that's probably as clear as you can possibly ever get to the fact that maybe just keep his hands off. He can enjoy the numbers, but don't telegraph the numbers ahead of time. It's not going to do any good.
That's right. And he's not the only one who's in a position to do that. But nobody else, in my recollection, has ever done that.
Mm-hmm.
There's one instance where President Eisenhower may have done something like that, but that's a long time ago. And I just don't take that into account here. The current generation has never done anything.
One of the other columns that you had recently talks about some data that came out, some good numbers, I guess, as far as Indiana's concerned. It would rank third in the nation in growth of real per capita personal income back in 2016. And it's interesting that you would say, well, how come this never showed up on the bottom of the screen on CNN or on Fox News or something like that?
Or on Lakeshore Television.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, and I didn't hear it on your station. We just don't pay enough attention to all the information that's out there. Instead, we spend a lot of time being concerned about Stormy Daniels or stormy weather, and the things that really matter are very often ignored. I would like to see a situation where economists and other technicians, if you will, got more airtime so that they could tell us what's actually going on in the world, because so much of the news that we hear is basically the same news over and over, only the names have been changed.
Mm-hmm.
So-and-so was killed today by gunshots. Well, that's a very tragic situation. But what is more important is how many people were killed today by gunshots, not the particular incident that took place in Merrillville or took place in Hobart or took place in Valparaiso. The real question is what's happening in America. That's what's important. And we have a tendency to take a single incident, a single person, and feature that person rather than what that person represents in our society. Good or bad, these are the kinds of things that I think need to be addressed.
Well, Morton, we have one more column we'd like to take a look at. This was one that was put out on the public media around the state back in April. It was focusing on Indiana's job growth, and you noted how it seems to be lumped in areas, at least from the data that has come out over the years here. Tell us more about that and how we should look at it here, particularly in our corner of the state.
Well, unfortunately, I have a lot of cars in front of me, and I don't have the column in front of me. So I can't really go into the specifics. But it is true that the state has areas that have very good experiences with job growth, and there are other parts of the state that are just not seeing growth at all. And one of the problems that we have is that we really don't pay attention to some of the detail that's in there. I like to differentiate between growth and development. Growth is what we expect in our children, but if they just grow and they don't develop, then we say, well, we have a child who's got developmental problems, and they get in special ed classes. And with our communities, it can be the same way. We are so focused on growth and how many jobs, but the question is, what kind of jobs are we seeing? Are we seeing a greater diversification of jobs so that young people have more choices? Or are we seeing an absence, a squeezing down of the types of jobs that are available? If we have fewer jobs in the steel mills than we used to have, well, where do we have more jobs? And what kind of pay and what kind of benefits do they get? These are the kinds of things we need to really focus on, because that's what's ultimately important. The fact that we open a new burger restaurant in Crown Point doesn't really mean very much to me. When we open a Burmese restaurant in Crown Point, that expands my choices. That's what's important to me. That's a development in the economy.
Well, Morton, we're going to have to leave it at that, and we'll be back together again for more Eye on the Pie columns, to be sure. We're talking with Indiana economist and writer and public speaker Morton Marcus, who joins us from the road to talk about some of his recent Eye on the Pie columns. And as always, Morton, thank you for spending some time with us up here in Northwest Indiana today.
My pleasure. Well, now I just have to find out where I am. Not just the track.
Well, that's where the GPS comes in handy, I suppose, there too. Be careful any way you look at it. And thank you very much,
right.
Morton. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project connects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
67 is when Mayor Hatcher won, and I was at Bailey then. That was an exciting time for me, because on the weekends, we would go out and go door to door. There was a guy named Lou Drinkert, and Lou took the young people, and he would take us in his car over to Operation Push in Chicago, and he would take us going door to door for Mayor Hatcher. But I was very excited about it. My dad and my mom worked very hard, especially my dad worked really hard in the campaign. And that night was one that I'll never forget when he did win. And I remember my mom and I were at home trying to listen to the radio. My dad was down there and he came and got us. And 21st and Broadway was closed off completely. And people were just there, just excited and happy. But I do remember on that bus that next morning, everybody was excited. Even the people whose parents probably weren't for the mayor, at this point, everybody was for Mayor Hatcher, okay? And we were all excited, and especially to being bused to Glen Park and Bailey School, because there was tension. I think our energy, our positive and excited energy, was making them uncomfortable. And I don't think they were, and they showed on their face that they weren't happy about it. You know, a lot of people talk a lot about Mayor Hatcher winning for mayor, and of course, that was spectacular, and he was the first elected of a major city. But before him was Mayor Katz, who was Jewish, and they were equally, people in this community were equally not happy about there being a Jewish mayor. So there was a time, just a feeling going on during that time in 66, 67, before the mayor, when he won in 67. But going that whole time frame right there was not, it was just a time of transition, but not everybody was happy about the transition. That period of time, growing up in Gary, Indiana, I would not want to be anywhere else in the world. Because as a result of him becoming the mayor, it became like literally the black Mecca for this country. And everybody wanted to come to Gary, no matter who they were, if they were an entertainer of some sort, if they were involved in politics, you name it, they came. And so I was able to, you know, be up and close with these people. I don't think I would have that opportunity anywhere else.
You can find more regional stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. Ameristar Casino's newest gaming floor is open. In fact, it's already been used for special events. I had a chance to talk with Jamie Williams, who is the casino's director of marketing, just before last weekend's special event about the region's first landside gaming area.
Jamie, if you will, tell us a little bit about the planning that Ameristar and the parent company had thought about ahead of time, maybe even before the General Assembly went ahead and changed the rules to allow for construction of facilities on land as opposed to being strictly on the boat.
Well, the planning has been going on for quite a long time. It's, you know, once landside gaming was a thought in Indiana, the companies have looked at and said, hey, if we could build on land, where would we build? What would we do? Once the law was passed in 2015, it was full steam ahead. The planning started thinking about what was the best space to use, what would be the best for our customers to make it the room that we wanted it to be. And here we are, you know, over 2 years later with the opening of the room, close to 3 years it took.
Okay.
time.
If you will describe what the thoughts were, I guess, with the facility that you had before and now, what you've taken now and turned into this new gaming area.
The area that the High Limit Room is in kind of encompassed three or four different areas. We had a restaurant there, Burger Brothers, which is moving to the Pavilion. We had a credit office. Our My Choice area was there, but it was only open on the weekends. So most of the space was underutilized. It was closed for part of the week, maybe used a day here and there. So it really became the ideal location to say this would be a great place to put our High Limit Room for our guests.
Now, how much room was there available to be able to do everything that you've done now to it?
The room is about 15,000 square feet, so once we knocked down some walls and kind of combined the spaces, it really allowed us to create a comfortable environment with the right number of machines and tables for our customers.
Now, before you actually had a chance to use this space to make this new facility, where were some of the other high-stakes games and the other facilities located when they had to be on the boat?
They were separated on the boat, so our High Limit Table Game Room was located on the second floor of the vessel all the way to the front section, and our High Limit Slot Room was directly above it on the third level. They were smaller spaces, not as many amenities, harder to service, and probably not as comfortable for our customers.
Were they very, very busy rooms? As I'm saying, it's probably relatively so compared to the rest of the casino.
They were busy. When you have certain high-stakes games, they're not going to be as busy as the regular casino floor. But we held our own. We had a lot of players who enjoyed the rooms, who came and were very loyal to Ameristar. And this was something that we could do for them as well to make a better space for them to come and game in.
Okay. Well, Jamie, take us now through the process. The casino has the permission to go ahead and get the plans going that have been thought of ahead of time for what you want to do on land. Take us through the process of the actual construction and getting ready to open up the facility and how it's done so far.
The construction process, just like any process, there's going to be bumps and bruises. We started this process in early January and closing down the existing areas that were operating out of the current room, found new homes for them, and the construction process started. So it's been about 5 months, 5.5 months in the making. Like I said, some bumps and bruises along the way, but I think when you start tearing down walls anywhere, you're going to find that. So after 5.5 months, we started thinking about when the room would open, the timing of it, making sure our customers knew, inviting them, showcasing the room. And the feedback that we've gotten since we opened on May 24th has been phenomenal. The guests love the space. They love the environment, the service. Their favorite team members from the old rooms are working the new rooms, and those are people that they've built wonderful relationships with. But just the fact that everything they need is located in one space now, and it's convenient for them to get to, we've had a lot of positive feedback so far.
Now, as we're speaking here on Friday, you're getting ready for some special events that you can also, I guess, take advantage of this special room for, too.
Yeah, this room allows us to really showcase special events for our customers. We have the third leg of a Triple Crown table game tournament going on this Saturday. So we have our blackjack portion featuring the High Limit Room that starts tomorrow. And then we have a promotion every Saturday right now for our High Limit slot players where we're giving away free money every Saturday night. So they come in and they enjoy that. The room also features some buffet stations. So during these special events, we're able to offer food for our customers. So again, they don't have to leave the room for anything.
Mm-hmm. Now, besides having these special events and the opportunities that they're going to present to bring in people that maybe have never either been to the casino boat completely or certainly not to what the changes have allowed them to be able to do, how easy is it now to attract people to come over to Ameristar now, especially in the light of the fact that we have so many boats in the region?
Well, I think we have a little bit of an edge up. We have a beautiful hotel room here. Our guests can come in and stay right on property. Our rooms are spacious, over 500 square feet, offer all the amenities that you can think of. And then it's just a short walk to the casino floor from our hotel. With the restaurants that we offer, from fine dining to sports bars, casual dining, there's really nothing that our guests would have to leave the property for. So I feel that we can offer them a full package of once they get here, everything they need is here. And now on top of it, there's an exceptional high limit experience for them to take advantage.
I know that, some of the other casinos here in the region are making announcements of plans for expansion and the like. So whether they're not been spurred on because of what Ameristar has already done, it's something I guess you have to keep your eye on. You have to keep an eye out for what the competition's doing, don't you?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's, you know, in any business, you always have to keep an eye on what your customers or your competition are doing. And, you know, to be the leader in that is always a good feeling to know that, you know, we were first to market and that we were able to provide a different and unique experience for our customers. And I think our customers appreciate that we've taken their feedback and their thoughts into consideration when we've built the room. And since we've opened, you know, minor adjustments we've made to the room, it's, you know, it's important that our customers feel comfortable and that they enjoy the space, because that's what's going to keep them coming back, even if the competition tries to replicate something that we've done.
I know that probably the closest is going to be to a big project, I would imagine, is what the folks over in Gary are planning to do. They want to take advantage of the opportunity to be located on land, and they're probably wanting to do a complete relocation if they can. So you have to, I say, you have to keep an eye out for what the other casinos in the region are doing, I would imagine.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, we always do keep an eye on what they're doing. We like to be aggressive in what we're doing, and we feel that we have a great package that we can offer to our guests, and the service that we provide is exceptional, and that's what's going to keep them coming back. But, you know, the competition is always going to be changing, just like we are, so we keep an eye on it, but we try to focus really on what we're doing and servicing our customers and making sure when they come here they have the best experience.
Are there any other plans that Ameristar Casino here in East Chicago would like to be able to take advantage of now that you've got this new high-stakes room open, ready for business, and it's already being well used?
You know, there's always going to be thoughts and brainstorming of what the next move is. Right now, we're continuing with a remodel of our entire casino floor, so every floor on the vessel is getting redone and updated, and it's something that our customers are definitely going to appreciate. So that's our current project right now. You know, it's about a $16 million project. So when that's all done, you know, obviously we'll take a look and always be thinking about what the next opportunity is.
Jamie, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Jamie Williams is the Director of Marketing for Ameristar Casino here in East Chicago.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Our next guest is involved with a very special project and working with others in her office. A team of art curators are very busy as we speak right now, not here in Northwest Indiana or even in Chicago, but in Venice, Italy, for a very special event that is underway over there, a biennial event, as a matter of fact, that has an opportunity to spotlight local architects, landscape architects, and designers on an international stage. And with us to talk about it, we have Anne Louis, who is an assistant professor with the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. Anne, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, Chris. Thank you so much for having me.
This is such an interesting project. I got word of the Venice, I'm going to pronounce this wrong, Architecture Biennale. If I'm pronouncing it right, I'm not very good at Italian, and so I messed it up, I know, but that's all right, because you can do a better job of explaining it than I can. Tell us a little bit about what this particular architectural event is and why it seems to be, of course, maybe there's a good reason why it's held in Venice, Italy.
Yeah, absolutely. So listeners might be a little bit more familiar with the Chicago Architecture Biennial. But the Venice Architecture Biennale is a biennial exhibition of architecture that is the largest and actually the most internationally visible exhibition of architecture in the world. And it's held every 2 years in Venice, and it's comprised of kind of two exhibitions. One is an overall exhibition. This year it's called Breeze Space. That was curated by Grafton Architects, Irish architecture practice. And then there's also representation from different nations. So the way that I've been explaining it to my parents is that it's kind of like the Olympics of architecture. And this year we were really proud to represent the United States with a team that was largely based out of Chicago.
How often does that happen? Were you able to have a locally based team, in this particular case from the Art Institute of Chicago? Or I guess before you might have team members, just to, you know, but it would be scattered about, wouldn't you?
Yeah, so this is the first time that the U.S. Pavilion has been commissioned by two Chicago institutions, the School of the Art Institute of Chicago and the University of Chicago. Of course, the pavilion does represent what we see as the kind of cutting edge or best practices across the United States. So while we have representation from Chicago with Studio Gang and Amanda Williams and Andres Hernandez, we also have practices from the East Coast, Village Gifidio Renfro, State Landscape Architecture, and also from the West Coast, including Teddy Cruz and Fauna Foreman.
Tell us a little bit more here about your colleagues from the Art Institute of Chicago and what they seem to specialize in, and certainly why they are involved in this particular project.
Yeah, absolutely. And maybe it's worth telling you a little bit about the exhibition overall.
Okay.
So the title of the exhibition is called Dimensions of Citizenship. And the exhibition asks two questions in general. And the first is, what does it mean to be a citizen today? And the second is, what is the role of architecture specifically in researching, understanding, and rendering visible these questions of belonging? I think you and probably most of the listeners have noticed that in recent months and recent years, questions of citizenship have become increasingly important, whether that's about kind of international sovereignty at airport lobbies or Black Lives Matter taking to the street or the issue of Confederate monuments. And the issue is that architecture has actually been at the core of all these questions, so architecture in the built environment. So for us, it was especially important that the discipline start to have a kind of voice in these conversations that really matter to us as citizens.
I noticed that in some of the description that's on the website, talking in more detail about this particular event, that you talk about, it talks about the team members that we mentioned before, include architects and landscape architects and theorists and artists as well, and they're trying to grapple with some very unique problems and the meanings of the problems, too, when you talk about what does the word citizenship mean. And like you say, in this particular case, we're talking about it from an architecture standpoint. It's not just a civic standpoint. Is it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I think that the question is how do you organize an exhibition about these big questions, right? And what's the role of architecture in these conversations? So we've organized, from a curatorial perspective, we've organized this exhibition around seven scales. So we're talking about citizenship from the body all the way to the cosmos. And those scales include region, nation, network, globe. So we're talking about citizenship not just associated with a nation state, but also maybe what it means to be part of a neighborhood, part of a city, part of a voting district or a watershed. And we think that those questions are really important today, especially for architects and designers to kind of reckon with and talk about.
Let's take a few minutes here and talk about what these seven scales are all about and the participants in each of these scales. Like you say, you're breaking it down into looking at different aspects of what citizenship is in particular. Tell us here first about what Amanda Williams and Andre Hernandez are working on, and they're the group, I guess, called Citizen. Tell us first what they are doing as far as what their participation in the U.S. Pavilion is this time.
Yeah, absolutely. Amanda Williams and Andres Hernandez are Chicago-based artists, designers, and educators. And for their work at the scale of the citizen, they've been focused on the issue that Black women's space matters. So for them, they'd like to point out that many citizens today don't actually have access to the full rights and privileges of citizenship, and that many people are made to feel marginalized in public space or are the victims of violence in public space. And that's something that I think everybody has noticed kind of more recently has come up in the news, but has been issues that we've been dealing with here in the U.S. For hundreds of years now. And so their work is an exploration of this idea that Black women's space matters through materiality and through enclosure. They've been working with this fantastic Chicago-based artist, Shawnee Crow, who works with hair and braiding. And their work in the U.S. Pavilion tries to kind of challenge and reckon with the exhibition space, which is a kind of Monticello-like pavilion, by creating what they're calling a fugitive space, a space for hiding, but also for creating kind of a rich interiority in which one has to kind of create often to survive in moments when one is marginalized through conditions of citizenship. So they've been really inspired, for example, by historical figures like Harriet Tubman and Harriet Jacobs, Black women who have kind of used Black spatial practice to create liberatory environments in the past and kind of bring this forward to issues of architecture today.
Mm-hmm. One of the other ones I happen to notice on the list here with the Studio Gang and have some members, of course, from Chicago, is one particular artist's way to put some interesting light on, I guess, what was referred to as the antithesis of a man on a horse on a pedestal. And this actually comes from a piece of it's architecture work that was shown, or was, I guess, was put up on display, which I guess got put into storage. Tell us what actually was there in Memphis, Tennessee, on landing, and how it's ended up in Venice, Italy.
Yeah, so Studio Gang has been working with the city of Memphis, Tennessee, on a longer project to create a new civic space at a site that they have there called Cobblestone Landing. And Cobblestone Landing is really, it's a fraught site. It's a difficult site because on one hand, it was the heart of the Memphis economy. It was a site where cotton bales were unloaded. On the other hand, it was a site where slave ships docked, right? So for a city like Memphis that's reckoning with these histories of inequality and of segregation, they're kind of asking, what does it mean to make a civic space or a monument that is inclusive, that includes the voices of many citizens going forward? And what's amazing about what Jeannie Gang did for the U.S. Pavilion in Venice is that she shipped about 800 stones all the way to Venice from the Cobblestone Landing. And what's important about this project is it was kind of a pause in their work to create a public space in Memphis to take a look more closely at these stones, which kind of meant so much to the city, and how to think about how to transform them or bring them together or revisit them in a way going forward that includes the voices of many citizens from around Memphis. So part of their work was a bunch of community engagement with people who live in the city today, whether that's policymakers or activists or people who have been shaping their environment in different ways from both kind of a grassroots level and also from a policy perspective, talking to Memphis citizens about what it means to commemorate their city going forward and also create a kind of inclusive space that represents Civitas in the future.
Now, Anne, we're going to have to, unfortunately, have to cut it short as far as describing all seven of these areas, but there is one more that we do have time for that we want to talk about, because this brings into light the fact that this event is happening in Venice, Italy. You think of Venice, you think of the canals, you think of the huge lagoon, you think of the Doge's Palace, you know, all the other landmarks, the classic architecture that's in Venice, Italy, and then one particular project uses the lagoon as a way to bring about this topic of citizenship. Tell us about what Ecological Citizens is involved in.
Yeah, Scape Landscape Architecture is an amazing practice based in New York. And for their work, we've been joking that they've been using the U.S. Pavilion exhibition space as a storage shed for a longer project that they're doing. So Venice, like many other coastal and wetland regions, has been facing kind of an ecological crisis, both from climate change and also from human impact on the environment. They've lost like 70% of their wetlands in the last 100 years. And so what Kate is showing in the U.S. Pavilion is some ecological infrastructures. Those are core logs, their willow bundles, and their e-concrete units, which are kind of human-scale interventions that can be used to buttress kind of wetland regions against further ecological crisis. What's really important for me about this work is that there are many coastal regions that are facing this kind of risk. And sometimes climate change can feel like this kind of impossibly large topic that is too abstract or complicated for us to work on. On the other hand, Kate is showing kind of immediate ways that what she's calling ecological citizens can kind of become guardians and allies of not just other people in our communities, but also kind of critters, bugs, insects, and the kind of rich environments that we live as part of and are responsible for.
Now, Anne, if you will tell us, are there any members from the Chicago team that are still over in Venice, or have you all made it back to the Art Institute of Chicago? How long are they going to stay over in Venice?
So the exhibition will be running through November, mm-hmm. And we really encourage anybody who has a chance to go to Venice to see the work. You can also learn more about the exhibition on dimensionsofcitizenship.org, which we're really excited about showing many of the work online. Most of the teams are back in their hometown, back in the U.S., getting to work on further projects. But we're really excited about the kind of duration of the exhibit and the chance for people to see it in the coming months.
Well, Anne Louis, thank you very much for spending some time with us, sharing what you know and what they had to witness there in Venice, Italy. And we hope that this will in turn bring more people an interest in certainly what's happened and more interest in the involvement of art and architecture and citizenship. You can find out more, of course, about this by going to the Art Institute of Chicago's website. There's a special page there on the website that will tell you all about this and talk about these other organizations that have been involved in this, too. And thank you for spending time with us today.
Yeah, thank you so much, Beth.
Anne Louis is an assistant professor at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. This is Regionally Speaking. Docents of the American Passenger Rail Heritage Foundation were back on the South Shore trains lately to ride, to educate, to basically enthrall everyone and get them involved in those people who ride the train in a little history lesson. Robert Taburn is the executive director of the American Passenger Rail Heritage Foundation. He talked recently with Lakeshore Public Radio Sharon Jackson about what people are learning when they're riding the train these days.
So tell me about the organization and what your purpose is. Yeah, the American Passenger Rail Heritage Foundation's Rail Rangers program. We've been around for about 3 years, and we provide onboard educational programs. We do this several times a year on private historic rail excursions, but our main focus in the last year has been working with the wonderful folks over at the South Shore in Northern Indiana Commuter Transportation District to educate passengers about what they see outside their window between Chicago's Millennium Station and South Bend, the Northwest Indiana, Gary, and Michigan City, Miller, and all the communities in between. We tell people what they see outside their windows. They're passing through the state park and the National Lakeshore. We tell a lot of interesting stories about the people, places, history, everything you see outside the window. You know, we have a saying that no one would watch the Travel Channel or maybe the History Channel with the audio turned down. You wouldn't want to listen to it on mute. Imagine all the things you'd be missing. Well, we're kind of the audio that goes along with your train rides. You actually know what you're seeing outside your window.
Yeah, you might want to watch it for the beautiful scenery going by,
yeah.
But without the audio, it would certainly be a lot less richer and a lot less content-filled and, yeah, a lot less fulfilling. So why is it important that people know what they're seeing out the window?
Well, I think there's a lot of reasons why it's important. First, it's a, you know, 2-2.5 hour ride between Chicago and South Bend. And, you know, we want to get people, first of all, unburied from their laptops or their tablets or their e-reader or movie player and kind of appreciate the landscape. The South Shore line is actually very unique, and I bet a lot of people in Northwest Indiana don't realize that. In the short 90-mile stretch between Chicago and South Bend, you pass near or through 4 units of the National Park Service. The I&M Canal in Illinois, Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore over there in Indiana. You go near the Kankakee River Water Trail. And in the south side of Chicago, you go through right by Pullman National Monument. There's a lot of not only beautiful landscapes, but a lot of history that people don't realize they're traveling near. And when you see and understand the people, places, things outside your window, you're more likely to understand each other, maybe appreciate that beauty, maybe enjoy the state or national parks of Northwest Indiana a little bit more.
Did you say that you pass through these national parks like the I&M Canal on the South Shore?
You do. Three out of the four, you actually will pass through. The I&M Canal, it starts from Millennium Station all the way to 47th Street on the south side of Chicago. It's a National Heritage Corridor since the 1980s. Pullman was just declared a national monument in February 2015 by former President Barack Obama, and they're in the process of preserving some of the homes, the historic hotel where they built the trains, and you literally go a half a block from there. You see it right outside your window on the South Shore. Of course, you go through 15 miles of the Indiana Dunes, and over in St. Joseph County, you go very close to the Kankakee River, a brand-new national water trail, which was declared in 2016.
So tell me about the upcoming activities planned by the APRHF.
Yeah, we're really excited. We had a 6-month test partnership on the South Shore. We're a brand new program to see on Saturdays and Sundays, 2-3 times a month. We have our volunteers on, and passengers can ride and listen to our programs for no more than their regular train fare. We all volunteer to do these programs, and we don't make any money or anything from that. And passengers don't pay any more than their standard train fare to come and listen to us. So we narrate the route. We don't talk nonstop. We point out landmarks as we go along the route. And that's our main duty. We do one round trip out of Chicago at 8 in the morning. We get to South Bend a little after noon, a little downtime, turn around, and then do a program for our wonderful westbound passengers. And we do this in one car. And again, people can feel free to join us and learn a little bit about their communities in Northwest Indiana.
And what do the interpretive guides do, and how are they qualified and educated about what's out the window?
We've done about 4 to 6 months of research before we began our programs on the South Shore in August, this past August, and all of our guides have attended programs at the National Lakeshore. We've got information from some of the park rangers over at the National Lakeshore, and we've developed actually a 120-page book about all the things you see along the route between Chicago and South Bend. Our docents have driven the route. They've taken the train. They've researched the book that we've put together. And, of course, they have some of their own stories. We're always finding new stories. So there's a pretty rigorous training program to be one of our current 12 docents. We have a couple more going through training. So, yeah, we do require a pretty extensive training program before our guides are signed off. We're always learning new sites. And one of my favorite things is, you know, we're learning new sites from some of our passengers. We've had a passenger on a trip a couple weeks ago point out a historic brewery across from Pullman National Monument, and there's a very interesting a horse motif that was built into this bar. And we did some research, and we found out that it was actually a Schlitz brewery from the 1890s. And doing further research, we found out that Pullman was actually a dry community. So there were tons of bars on the outskirts of the Pullman community on the south side of Chicago, but none in Pullman. So all the workers would go out to these bars, lining the tracks on the other side of the tracks, as you would say, the other side of the tracks, to go drink. And so our passengers are always pointing out questions of what's this, what's that? And if we don't know the answer, you know, it's still a learning process for us. And we enjoy that, learning new routes to point out to future passengers. We enjoy learning about new sites. Like passenger might ask, well, what is that site? And if it's not something that we've already researched, we will go out and research that. And then if it's interesting, we'll incorporate it into the future program.
So it doesn't cost any more for a train fare to have one of your docents speak to the passengers.
Exactly. It's included in the regular train fare. So all they have to do is buy a regular ticket, check out our website for the 2 to 3 times that we're on the train per month, and then just come and the car is marked with some yellow signs. You just come and sit down in the car. Seating is on a first-come, first-served basis, and it does get pretty crowded. But yeah, we all volunteer our time, and we don't charge anything. It just you pay your train, regular train fare that you would to ride, and you get to participate. It's a fun, pretty economical, family-friendly thing to do for the spring and summer here coming up.
When do you guys go out on the train?
We do one round trip from Chicago, because most of us are Chicago-based. We leave Chicago at 8:40 in the morning, and there's about 20 stops that people can either hop on or hop off between the Chicago's Millennium Station and South Bend. You don't have to ride the entire route. If you do, we get to South Bend a little after noon Eastern time. We have a little layover. We then do a westbound program that leaves South Bend at 1:05 Eastern time and gets to Chicago at 2:39 Central time. So people can hop on or off. We'll have some people who just get on in Chicago and we'll ride to Dune Park and then spend a couple hours and catch us on the way back. So there's a lot of opportunities in different stations that people can hop on and off and listen to part of our program, the whole thing, whatever they want to do.
Why do you have this organization?
Yeah, we started the organization about 10 years ago to educate people about the role that passenger train travel has played in American history. A lot of people these days don't appreciate the role that the Transcontinental Railroad might have played or steam engines. Now that we have cars and planes and can get somewhere quickly. And some of that history we felt was dying off. So the American Passenger Rail Heritage Foundation, which is actually headquartered in Northeast Missouri, started with a train lookout point and an exhibition of Amtrak history, a small museum, and some train cars out in Missouri. And it was a great regional thing, but we expanded out in 2015 doing these educational programs on private rail excursions, and then eventually it transitioned also into the South Shore last year. We just feel it's important to educate people about rail history, but also the beautiful parks and trails and all the wonderful things in Northwest Indiana. Maybe they didn't realize was in their neighborhood or not too far away from them.
Do you guys have any exhibit where you could see the highlights of the features that you're talking about?
Yeah, we travel, our interpretive guides will often travel with what we call a mobile visitor center. So we have some props of some of the things that you're able to see along the way. For example, we have a little bit of dune sand and we have glass jars, because a lot of people don't realize that a big chunk of the dunes was kind of scooped up and moved away. Some of that land of the beautiful 200-foot-high sand dunes was moved as landfill for Chicago and even Northwestern University up in Evanston was built on Indiana dune soil. And a lot of that land was also used to make ball jars, glass jars. So we carry some of the props to show people that, hey, the sand from Northwest Indiana, there's some of those sand dunes that you don't see. We're actually these jars. Sometimes we carry pieces of sand that were hit by lightning, and we have pictures of some of the plants that you see along the way. One of the stories that people love is we talk about jellyfish that inhabit this little lake called Sogmi Lake it's up near Hudson Lake, and we carry pictures of what these little jellyfish are, no bigger than a dime or a quarter. They float and come up to the surface in August. So we carry a lot of visuals to enhance these passengers' trips on the South Shore.
Do you have the upcoming dates that you guys are going to be on the trains?
I do. Our dates are 2 to 3 times a month, and they are up on our website right now. If you go to southshoreline.org or dunestrain.com, we have all our dates, and then we have dates, probably a scattering of almost a dozen dates posted all the way to the end of the summer if you want to go check that out. But it's 2 to 3 times a month, Saturdays or Sundays, all summer long, and really it'll be all year round.
What is the largest crowd you guys have ever spoken to?
Oh, we've had a couple, pretty much the whole car full, which is over just under 100 people. We've had this year alone, we have 4 private groups who've requested us to do programs for them. 2 of the groups are with the Duneland Seniors out of Chesterton. And then we have a school group who just contacted me a couple days ago from New Carlisle, just into St. Joseph County in Northwest Indiana, who's interested in riding with us. So we'll do programs for school groups, senior groups, as they contact us. We'll have that car jam filled of up to 100, almost 100 people if we can.
That's Robert Taborn, who's the executive director of the American Passenger Rail Heritage Foundation, talking with Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson about the onboard educational programs that this volunteer group is offering on the South Shore Line. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for being with us. And we'll be back with you tomorrow with more features and more information for you on Regionally Speaking.